Hi, I'm Matthew Kind. Every Monday, look for a fresh new episode where I'll take you behind the scenes and interview the insiders that are shaping the rapidly evolving cannabis industry. Learn more at cannainsider.com. That's CANNAinsider.com. Now here's your program. Our guest today is on the cutting edge of research where laboratory science meets cannabis. As you're about to hear, we have reached what is possibly one of the largest milestones in creating pure, consistent cannabinoids in a lab. I am pleased to welcome back Kevin Chen of Hyasynth Bio. Kevin, welcome back to Can Insider.
Hi, Matt. Great to be back.
Give us a sense of geography. Where are you in the world today?
I am based in Montreal, Canada. So I guess a little bit further north from you, but not too far.
Okay. And we were just talking about pumpkin. What is it about pumpkin this time of year? Everybody wants pumpkin spice, pumpkin latte. I'm not making fun of them because I'm one of those people, but what is that?
Not sure. Like I was saying, maybe it's a genetic thing or same as the reasons why birds like to fly south this time of year. Maybe we have some kind of psychological attraction to gourds and to pumpkins and to squashes around this time of year. I've got some squashes that I'm going to cook up myself later today or next week sometime. But I'm a pumpkin fan too. Why not?
Yeah. Maybe it's nesting or something. I can't figure burrowing. Well, Kevin, as I mentioned, you've been on the show before, but please remind us, what on a high level does Hyasynth Bio do?
Yeah, so we're a biotechnology company. Our main focus is on creating strains of yeast that produce cannabinoids. So instead of growing a plant and having soil and adding water to that, you just have a big steel tank. You add yeast, which looks kind of the same as baker's yeast, to that big steel tank. You add some sugar and some water. You let that grow for about a week, and then at the end of that, you extract pure cannabinoids from that yeast culture. And we do that by modifying the yeast cells themselves so that they have the ability to produce cannabinoids. And that's genetic engineering, it's synthetic biology. It's about, you know, looking at the genome of a yeast and a genome of a cannabis plant and then taking all the genetic parts in a cannabis plant that are related to cannabinoid production and putting those into a yeast genome so that the yeast on its own can produce cannabinoids. And by way of analogy for anyone that's confused right now, this is the same way that we've produced insulin for the past 50 years or so, where insulin is always coming from an engineered bacteria or engineered yeast, and it's actually a human gene for insulin that's been put inside of a yeast or a bacteria genome. And then what, you know, these pharmaceutical manufacturers will do is just, you know, cultivate that bacteria, that yeast, and then extract pure insulin at the end of that. So we're doing the same kind of process, but for cannabinoids, for all kinds of like great reasons that we're going to talk about today too.
Okay. Yeah. So I've been banging the drum about this. I think this is the third time you've been on the show in a couple of years. I've been up to your lab in Montreal, and I've kept on thinking, wow, if this really, really works, it's going to be huge for the cannabis and hemp industry and all these other industries that we'll discuss. But it sounds like you've made your first sale. Can you talk about that and what you sold and why it's important?
Yeah, definitely. So I'll start with, like, you know, what we've sold is CBD and CBDA, if you want to make a distinction between the carboxylated and the non-carboxylated form. That's more of like a finer detail. But at the heart of it, what we've done is successfully taken our yeast strains from our lab, handed them over to a manufacturer, had that manufacturer, like, we gave the manufacturer instructions on how to, you know, produce, you know, the CBD using our strains. They followed those instructions. And at the end of that, we ended up with some like ultra pure 99%+ pure CBD and CBDA. And I would describe it as like a pretty small batch, like where I'm going to have a few small but important customers around the world with this batch. And the key thing that I want to emphasize with it is that, you know, this is the first time we've taken our yeast strains out of our own hands and actually done, you know, we've essentially operated the business model that we want to scale up with, almost, where we're trying to take advantage of manufacturers that exist all around the world that, you know, can do fermentation, enable them to use our strains of yeast to do the manufacturing of these, you know, key ingredients, and have them do that like consistently, robustly, and cost effectively, so that we can actually make, you know, these cannabinoids into products that are available worldwide and that are available with the right quality and consistency, the same as how, you know, insulin is available worldwide.
Okay, so it's kind of analogous to how Coca-Cola, you know, back at headquarters has to get the syrup exactly right to a specification that can be duplicated. And then they kind of ship out small amounts to the bottlers, and the bottlers, you know, they understand the spec, and then they make their cola on site. They add the water that's to spec, the carbonation, the bottle. It's all done kind of at the edge, where you're getting the formulation just what it needs to be there by your standards or by the customer standards, by both. And then when it's time to scale up, you send them essentially the recipe and the strain in a small form that can be expanded greatly on site. Is that right?
Yeah, exactly. That's a perfect analogy, and also a good analogy because, I mean, I would say large brands like Coca-Cola have taken interest in cannabinoid-related products too. So, and that's exactly what, you know, we essentially want to do here, so that we have this level of consistency that starts to look more like that consistency that Coca-Cola has, where you can get it anywhere in the world. It's always the same look, the same taste, the same brand. And we want to have that be something that people can rely on and that brands can rely on. And right now, if you imagine doing that with cannabis or a hemp growth operation, I mean, to some extent, people have tried to do this in the, you know, cannabis industry, and there's so many fine details about, you know, how you grow the cannabis plant, what genetics are involved, how much lighting or water, or, you know, different fertilizers, pesticides that all go into that process, that it's incredibly hard to replicate that. And on top of that, you have to deal with the local regulations around each of those, like, you know, cannabis growth operations you might want to operate around the world. And that's going to add another layer of complexity. And that makes it, like, really difficult to actually, you know, for any larger pharma company or larger brand to really want to invest in that, because there's so many of these risks and so many unique cases involved. And so really, really wanted to focus on, like, how generic our process can be and how robust it can be, and how it can be, you know, this thing that people can actually rely on. And that makes it, yeah, a lot like the way that Coca-Cola might manage their manufacturing practices, or any multinational brand that has, like, you know, that crosses borders, or that has, like, a nationwide, you know, supply chain, because that's ultimately where we see these products going, is that we're, you know, cannabis has always been on its way to becoming part of that mainstream, but, and it's come close, but it's not there yet, right?
Yeah. Well, one of the things about, you know, we mentioned the purity, but the thing that one of the other variables I'm focused on is the speed. Let's talk about how much faster this would be to get these cannabinoids versus growing them, you know, indoor or outdoor in the plant, and then harvesting, curing, and extracting.
Yeah. And we highlighted that in our press release stuff about this, just because it is one of the most important aspects of this. And to give, like, some, you know, experience to this, our process runs in 1 week. And that means that by the time, like, if you started to, you know, grow some cannabis plants, and I was growing my yeast, on day one, we said, like, go today. Then, like, at the end of this week, I'd have, like, a few hundred milligrams or a few grams of yeast, or maybe a few kilograms, depending on how large a batch I try and run with this stuff. But at the end of the week, I have my first product, and then you'll have your first, like, maybe seedlings at the best. And that's one of the key things here, is that we're operating on a week batch process, and that's a huge improvement in efficiency. And that changes the way that the supply chain works as well a bit. But with plants, of course, you're waiting, like, 3 months to grow these plants. And then at the end of that, you have to do your processing. And for us, it's like this one, like, you know, 1 week turnaround. Every week there's a new batch. And that's going to make a big difference for how much you can make and how fast you can make it.
Right. Okay. I said curing early, but that's not necessarily what needs to be done for extraction. But still, there's a huge amount of time delta here that will be able to be capitalized on in the future. But it's not just about speed in growing cannabinoids. You know, these big multinationals, or even small companies too, they really need lab cultures, because it provides something they just can't get from extracted cannabinoids. Can you talk about what exactly, why they're gravitating to these lab-grown cannabinoids, what it does for them, what itch it scratches?
Yeah, and I'll clarify a bit of the language there. I think lab-grown is a nice one way to put it. We also like to use the word cultured cannabinoids or biosynthesized cannabinoids. I think biosynthesized cannabinoids is the most popular word right now, but I don't like lab-grown as much because then it sounds like we're growing them in an actual lab, and that's not really what we're doing. We're still doing, in some sense, agriculture. It's just a different kind of agriculture. It's agriculture inside of cells, and then you can use the word cellular agriculture, which is another fun topic. But anyways, your question was about like why are people gravitate towards this stuff? I mean, I've spent like the past 6 years looking at this industry, and I mean, to some extent, I've been doing everything that I can to get people to start gravitating toward this stuff. And I think what it boils down to is a bit of those hard metrics of like where it's coming from, how it's being made, and what that means for the end consumer. And what I mean by that is that we can, you know, have a supply chain that is always going to have product available. That's a product that like you always use and you always want. And we saw that issue in Canada where medical cannabis providers would run out of supply suddenly of like the strain that somebody was using. So if you can imagine if like, you know, you're using one dose of one particular cannabis strain, it's working really well for you for whatever condition you're dealing with, and then suddenly they're out of stock. And that's totally unacceptable from like a pharmaceutical supply chain kind of thing. Like if the world ran out of insulin, that'd be like the biggest scandal in the world. That's like millions of people that are suddenly in trouble. And so we can do that with this technology, and it's been done with the technology before. So that's one of the things that I think is key. Other things that are like a little bit softer as far as you know, what attracts people to things are getting into the sustainability and the efficiency of it. And sustainability in a sense that like, you know, we care about the planet, we should try and make products in environmentally friendly ways. And we know that cannabis cultivation is very not friendly for the environment in the amount of greenhouse gas output that you have, the amount of control you have to put into your process. And so we're really, you know, targeting that as like an interesting thing. And that ties into like, you know, what kind of companies are people building nowadays? And what do people care about from that consumer lens, where whether you're a small brand or a big brand, maybe small brands care about this more because they want to have like an edge over their competition and looking for these kinds of things that are like, oh, this will be the way that this will go and the way of the future. So therefore I'm gonna want to use the cultured cannabinoids or the biosynthetic cannabinoids. But even the major brands of today, I think are you know, tying on and getting behind these like sustainability, kind of organic, kind of green technologies, and that's what we are. That's what we provide with this industry. And it's not as like relevant as maybe like a, you know, you could argue that producing biofuels using a yeast might be another way of like more directly addressing an environmental issue with biotechnology. But that doesn't mean that we can't incorporate environment and sustainability into our pharmaceutical manufacturing and into manufacturing of our consumer products as well.
Yeah. So some of these large food and beverage companies and other types of companies, they want that purity, consistency, and scale. And they can't really get that through plants because even if they have a mother plant, the seedling or the clipping that they take off the mother plant may be grown in a different environment every time. You know, the conditions, environmental conditions are different, so the outcome may be different. But we're really talking not like a mother plant, but a mother culture here that is essentially identical or is cloned and reproduced over and over again. Is this kind of the moment where you feel the multinationals are like, okay, we have a mature industry that's ready to give us cannabinoids and we can start looking at it as an ingredient?
Yeah, definitely. And you're exactly right about that analogy of having a mother plant and the conditions, except I guess in our case, we have like, trying to like tie into that analogy. I'm like, we do have a mother culture. We have seed cultures that we store and they're all like super consistent. And then you grow that seed culture into like huge volumes and it is still consistent. There's no like genetic or environmental variation, or at least you have control over like all of the environment that goes into your steel tank. And there's no airflow concerns or like, you know, humidity being like in half the greenhouse being different from the other half of the greenhouse somehow. And all of these things are easily controlled and consistent across our batches. So that's definitely true. And you could imagine like, you know, not just large scale multinational brands that people are familiar with, but also large scale ingredient suppliers that are starting to catch on to this as well, where they can see this as a process they can incorporate into their own manufacturing facility and then have a new product line, which is like, you know, essentially, I mean, what it boils down to is an ingredient supply ecosystem where we're providing the technology to enable this all to happen. And then there's manufacturers who are able to like produce the ingredient at large scales and move that into the larger brands who are their main like clients and purchasers. And that's all like, I guess with the way pharmaceutical ingredient supply works is it's like there is a lot of different parties involved. But it starts with this. It starts with this like, you know, having some kind of foundation to stand on, and one that doesn't rely on the cannabis plant. And I'm reflecting back on like, you know, some earlier stories from the cannabis industry where people really wanted to have special genetics or special strains, and maybe those strains were tied more to their name or their brand rather than their actual chemical composition almost. And that's going to go away. That's like, you know, we don't need that kind of thing, and it's not very useful from like a pharmaceutical standpoint either. When you're talking about like, you know, what's the actual ingredient here? Like, what's actually giving us the benefit? And then we have like the cannabinoids, of course, and that's what we focus on. So that's another maybe big change of mindset, is that it's less about plants and strains and greenhouses and indoor grow versus outdoor grow and hand trim versus not hand trim, whatever. Like all these things kind of just start to fade away, and we can focus on what's actually helping people and what's actually the active ingredient of the product, and how we can use that in the best possible way to treat, whether it's a skin condition or epilepsy or I guess to some extent like a an alternative to like alcohol on a Friday night, let's say.
yeah. Well, I mean, the big story here and the reason I get excited about this is that it finally paves the way for an international cannabis brand or CBD or hemp brand. I mean, we almost couldn't be more fragmented or decentralized industry than we are. And I like all the small mom and pop businesses. I think they're fun and I enjoy that. At the same time, it would be great if there was like one brand that the whole world understood was cannabis, because I think that would really catalyze the adoption of cannabis, especially away from other traditional medicines and different, you know, maybe even cannibalize alcohol if we can get more cannabis out there. You know, I mentioned Coke, but I also think about like other brands that wouldn't exist if there wasn't some way to standardize them. You know, McDonald's, Adidas. I mean, that's not food or medicine, but I mean, the shoes are essentially the same all over the place. And so now we have this opportunity, and we have enough countries that are legalizing, at least, you know, if not THC, then non-psychoactive cannabinoids. What's your guess? Which type of product will go global first, or at least be on multiple continents with one brand? Will it be a supplement? Will it be food? Will it be, what will it be?
Yeah, that's a good question. And definitely, yeah, it's exciting times internationally and seeing who's developing which regulations. And actually, reminds me of another point where it'd be really nice to move some of the dial there with regulations in different countries, or how people even look at this stuff, where like they can look at our products and say like, that's not, you know, it's not coming from cannabis. Like, we're trying to regulate cannabis, and it reminds me of the whole development of the Canadian cannabis regulations, where there was like, you know, years of task forces and figuring out how to grow the plant and how to regulate that process, and all that kind of, you know, again, starts to fade away a bit when you start to think about like, well, fermentation, like we have fermenters, like we understand that. We can call somebody tomorrow and ask them how to produce things in fermenters, and they'd have like, you know, 50 years of expertise in that. And then in cannabis is a lot of like, you know, from the ground up kind of thinking, or maybe the most experienced cannabis growers were obviously doing it legally for a very long time. So I'm excited for what that might look like on a regulatory standpoint worldwide. But as far as what do you think is going to be worldwide? That's a good question. I think there is, pharmaceutical products is like, you know, once you get an approval somewhere, then like, getting that to track around the world is not too challenging to some extent, I guess. If you want to think about, like, you know, what are global barriers to, like, how we make cannabinoids available to people who need them. That's one thing that to some extent already exists with companies like G2B Pharmaceuticals. But I think from a standpoint of less pharmaceutical and more into, like, the consumer range, it seems like cosmetics are one of the more perceived as acceptable kind of areas where you might have, like, a skincare product that has this stuff in it, as opposed to one that somebody has to consume orally, for example. And that's ties into, like, some of the different regulatory and maybe even, like, emotional perspectives on cannabis or on cannabinoids in general as well. Because I guess you're not going to, like, rub something on your skin and then get high or something like that, right? You don't, like, that's not how people normally think about using cannabis. So therefore, we might have, like, some fresher perspective from, like, the stricter governments around the world to try and, like, enable these kinds of products to exist. But the other nice thing, I guess, that exists already is how the perspective of CBD in, like, Europe, for example, is still complicated, but, like, a lot more open to allowing CBD oils to exist in, like, the health and wellness and nutritional supplement kind of area. And so to some extent that's, you know, CBD oils might be, like, the first one that really starts to become more available anywhere in the world.
Yeah. Like, similar to maybe, like, a 5-hour energy drink, there might be something you see everywhere that's a small little container that you drink or in some way that's just instantly recognizable that'll just be around everywhere. So this is interesting. There's also another benefit to the lab-grown cannabinoids in that it's kind of easier to experiment with rare cannabinoids, and not that they're actually rare, it's just that they're not widely adopted at the moment. Can you talk a little bit about cellular agriculture with rare cannabinoids?
Yeah, definitely. And that's one of the super interesting things that excites me a lot about our technology is that with the cannabis plant, we know that there's 150 cannabinoids and there's the main ones, which are THC and CBD. To some extent, CBG as well, and it's a slightly different one. But either way, there's ones that cannabis produces in large quantities and ones that are produces in, like, very, very small quantities. And some of the latest research and some clinical trials are starting to investigate, like, what is the potential of these more rare cannabinoids. And that's an area where if I take THCV or CBDV as an example, like, that might be like 0.0001% of, like, a cannabis flower. So if you wanted to extract a gram of that, you might need, like, 100 kilograms of cannabis flower. And that doesn't make sense as, like, a process. There's just not enough there. But with a engineered yeast, we can we have yeast strains that produce THCV and CBDV. And we've done that successfully and cloned that pathway. And that work to figure out how to, like, get a yeast to produce these unique compounds is a matter of, like, engineering, just, like, looking at these genes, how to assemble them properly, and then you have your yeast strain in the end. And that takes months of time, not years. And it's not about, like, having a breeding program for cannabis that you're going to, like, you know, just breed strains until you get the right one. Like, we know exactly what we're changing and exactly what we're doing, and our process for producing these rare cannabinoids will be the same process that as what we use to produce the CBD and this THC that we'll make as well. So at the heart of it, we've got the ability to clone yeast strains that produce these rare cannabinoids. We've already done so in a lot of cases. And now that we've done that, it's the same process as what we'll use to produce CBD, essentially. So we can do the same thing and have, you know, large-scale quantities of these rare cannabinoids suddenly available for, ultimately for human consumption when you go through all the steps to prove them out. But first for researchers, of course, so that they can actually figure out how good these things are at treating different conditions. And that's, like, you know, to some extent, I think a lot of the ways that people talk about cannabis and how it's useful for so many things is coming from where there's some activity in these rare cannabinoids or in combinations of cannabinoids that right now you can't really get access to by growing just cannabis plants.
And how do you think cellular agriculture will affect the global supply chain for cannabis and hemp? I mean, I'm just thinking that if we can grow cannabinoids if we can use biosynthesis or cellular agriculture for cannabinoids, that can be done in more of an urban environment, or at least it doesn't have to be done in a rural environment, like outdoor farming, for hemp anyway. Do you think if there's any other ways that it might affect the global supply chain?
So it's one of the funnier ideas that I think about sometimes is that a lot of the products that are made using industrial fermentation are kind of like exist in the background a little bit. Like citric acid, I think, is one of the biggest ones where, like, you know, it's kind of in all your foods. It's a common product. It's vitamin C. It's like, it's everywhere. And that's made using fermentation. A lot of people don't really realize that, or you think it comes from oranges or something like that. But it's actually a fermentation process that's used to make that. And so in some ways, we sort of want cannabinoid production to start to fade away in that direction too, where you're aware of where it comes from. Or maybe actually I'll flip that around. I think historically, these things have faded into the background a bit. Nowadays, I think people care a lot more about where their products are coming from. And that's partly why, like, you know, cellular agriculture and biosynthesis just become really important. Because, you know, we don't just want to buy a piece of meat in a store and accept that as like just normal. We care about the cows and the farmers that are providing this to us, which is different today than it was maybe like, you know, 10 or 20 years ago or whatever. And what I mean by, like, you know, what we're going to do with cannabinoids is that we're going to remove some of that drama around like cannabis production and having that be like a big event, or having that be like a headline news about like, oh, this, you know, cannabis grow up is opening here, or like people getting upset about the smell of cannabis plants because their neighbor's growing them, or controversy around like the pesticide use around cannabis and how that's making people sick. Like these things start to fade away, and what people get in the end is that, you know, they have CBD that's available at a pharmacy, maybe the same way that you might want to look at aspirin, and you can buy, like, on your way to work, you can buy small jar of CBD oil, and it's not a big question of like, oh, am I going to take this and get sick later today, or am I, like, you know, contributing to global like greenhouse gases significantly by buying this like one CBD oil thing, or do I even know if there's like CBD in this CBD oil that I'm buying? Like, all these things those are problems that are, like, exist at the forefront today, and those are going to start to fade away, and then, you know, we have this like really nice and established and reliable ecosystem of manufacturing.
It seems like it, maybe correct me if I'm wrong, but cellular agriculture seems like it lends itself to automation much more so than plants being grown. Like, even when I visited your lab, you have things spinning and you have things in refrigerators and all the stuff going on that I can't even describe, but it looks like, hey,
good memory. You got a couple of things down already.
Right. And I was like, okay, so, you know, these things tend to be smaller than plants, at least when they start out. So all these things, these combinations that are being created of cellular agriculture can be done in an automated way. So that further brings down the price if all these experiments and all these initial cannabinoid creations done in an automated way once it's dialed in. Do you think that's accurate? Do you think that cellular agriculture is really going to bring down the price a lot?
Yeah, I think automation definitely plays a big role in this. And when you look at a fermentation facility, it's, you know, maybe a few people who sit behind a computer for their days, kind of watching the manufacturing process go. And it's way different from a cannabis production facility where you have, like, you know, people trimming plants and moving the plants around, and there's always like staff like handling these things, right? It's much easier to manage kind of one steel tank where you have all control of every single input and output in there, than it is to control like a field of cannabis plants that are just going to grow, and some of them are going to change, and it's going to be pests or like whatever. In terms of cost, there is definitely going to be a difference there, and that's an interesting one, just because fermentation is also, it's not a very cheap process. I wouldn't put it that way. I think a lot of like the most expensive ingredients on the planet, or the most expensive pharmaceuticals on the planet, are produced by fermentation. So I don't want to say too much about, like, you know, trying to bring down the cost of CBD. But there's definitely some cost benefit when you get to the right kind of scale. Let me think about what else I could say on cost. Yeah, because in the end, like cannabis, I guess you do have some kind of floor cost about how you have to handle the plant, how you grow it. One of the complicated things about cost that's being talked about right now in cannabis is like the price of CBD in the US, where everybody's like, oh, it's like so cheap. There's like, it's everywhere. No problem. And yet there's these issues of like, you know, CBD remediation, where there's like too much THC somehow in your hemp grow, and therefore you have to remediate it. There's issues from the FDA that are saying like, well, half the CBD products on the market don't even have CBD in them. You know, there's things like that that are starting to come out. And so like, yes, it's easy to grow hemp and you can try and do that. And then hemp is low cost, but the cost of CBD, of high quality CBD, of CBD that people can actually rely on, maybe that hasn't changed as much. And so there's still like, you know, a need obviously for technology like ours to kind of address the cost issue and those supply issues. And one of the other exciting things about cost is when you start to get the price of your ingredients into a range that is also suitable for having this be an ingredient in other kinds of products that already exist. And I remember one of my conversations with a food manufacturer a few years ago, which kind of went like this, where they were super excited about, you know, getting into CBD and having, you know, products that have CBD in them and making that like a new thing for them. But like they make and sell bars, like maybe they pay like $2 for the ingredients. They sell the bar for $4. And if I'm asking them to put like, oh, you know, pay an extra like $5 for like a gram of CBD to put into your products, that suddenly exceeds like what they understand is the cost dynamic and how this ends up actually in a grocery store or shelf or whatever. Cause you don't, you know, the cost of ingredients for them is really, really important. And if it's fundamentally past a certain point, then they can't commercialize products. And that's where, you know, we may be able to, with fermentation, I think we can definitely start to break those barriers and get to cost ranges that start to make sense for these kinds of ingredients. And the same thing about scale again, and so on and so forth. But those are my comments on cost. I think there's a bunch of thoughts there, but it's an interesting one.
So just describe a little bit of how you envision making money here. Is this through intellectual property licensing or some other kind of royalty agreement? What does that look like?
Yeah, in the end, it'll be a combination of those things. And it might depend a bit on who our partners are, how regulations need to be handled, and these kinds of things where, you know, it might make sense for some markets for us to get into just purely by licensing. It might make sense for others for us to get into by having a partner and then building our own facilities. And I'd say to some extent, we have some options there as far as like how we might deal with each situation. But at the heart of it, I think what we're looking for here is really the ingredients companies or those brands or those retailers and distributors who understand the market, who have products that are out there now, and maybe they have like a market share in some other sectors. And they're curious about like, oh, you know, maybe I could add CBD to my products, or maybe I'm well positioned to take in the supply and commercialize like a CBD product around the US or in Canada or around the world, wherever. And then they might want to, you know, start talking to us and say like what that might look like. What commitments do they need to make to have us partner with them, and what it takes to like get manufacturing online so they can start to do that kind of work. So it's it'll be a little bit complicated, but that's in the end, there's, you know, we have these kinds of options and choices to make, and it'll be exciting to have these conversations with these different partners or investors.
Okay, so you've achieved this milestone here in selling the first lab cellular agriculture CBD. Just for people that are listening and they're like, okay, what other milestones should I look for, Kevin, to see that this is all really happening and that this biosynthesis is going to become a larger and larger part of the cannabinoid market? What do you see? Like, what's the big one or two, maybe three things that you'd say, okay, look for this and then you'll know this industry is getting traction?
Yeah. Look for me flying overhead in like a private jet that I own or something. No, I'm just kidding. yeah, that was a good one. Eh? I think the milestones, like for years, it's always been a bit of the same, I would say, where we decided to get into this. We knew that the advantages of doing this process are that, you know, it's somewhat traditional. There's facilities worldwide. And so you can take your process from your lab, put it somewhere else, and somebody else can run it for you. And we've done that. We've done that at least, you know, at this level to show that it works. And so we'll do more of that. We'll do some larger scales. That'll be one thing to watch out for. The next thing is to prove that, of course, we can have partnerships around our technology and have ways that we can get access to the market. To some extent, we've done that with our relationship with Organigram, which is another big Canadian cannabis producer. And now we're looking for more partners around that and seeing who might be our best partner in maybe by country or by application and say like, okay, well, we're going to partner there for this product line. One of the exciting things that's coming up now too is also the idea of product diversity and having a range of cannabinoids that we can make and demonstrating that. So that's going to be another really interesting one where we start to show a bit more of our ability to diversify products. And with those three things, we've kind of covered the bases a bit as far as like, here's the advantages. We've proven that these advantages make sense and that they work. And then it'll be about growing the business. And of course, we're a startup. We're looking for more investors all the time a bit. But that's something else that we can talk about too, I guess.
Yeah. Where are you in the raising capital process?
Yeah, I would say, I mean, we're always fundraising. So there's a way for you guys, a way for people to reach out to me directly to say like, you know, if you're interested in whatever. But, and we are looking for more capital, of course, that's going to focus on the commercialization of our technology and, seeing who's around that can support that.
Okay. Well, Kevin, since you've been on the show a few times, I have some different personal development questions for you.
Cool. Yeah. You should change them up because otherwise people get bored.
You're right.
And then one day they'll know everything about me after a few times.
They might just clone you and say, we don't need Kevin anymore. We can cellular Kevin. So what other technologies do you see on the horizon that the public may not be totally appreciating how it might dramatically change their lives apart from what you're doing in the labs or anything else you just see anecdotally where you're like, hey, this is going to have a big impact. Maybe the people really don't understand it.
Yeah. I mean, one of the most exciting things to me is, all of the cellular agriculture and biosynthesis kind of field is interesting to me because you start to move the bar about like looking at your daily life and the objects that you eat or that you buy in the store and or that you have around you even today and seeing like, okay, well, maybe all these materials can be made using yeast or bacteria or something like that. And it seems like that reality is like coming up really, really fast. There's one of my favorite other companies is called Perfect Day Foods, and they're producing milk using yeast, essentially. And people in the U.S. can buy their ice cream. I can't buy their ice cream because I think they don't have international sales yet. If you're in the U.S., you can buy some of this interesting yeast-based ice cream, which is super exciting. So I see that like that's right on the horizon there. That's pretty much here now. And what's on the horizon is a bit more of that like what else can be made and how else can biosynthesis play a role in our lives.
Okay. Well, we mentioned ice cream. Do you have a favorite comfort food? Your go-to? I forget that concoction, that cheese curd they put on fries and stuff there in Montreal. It's really good. What's that called again?
Yeah, bingo. That's called poutine.
Poutine, yes.
Yeah.
Yes, that's really good. It sounds gross, but it's really good. What's your favorite comfort food? I don't want to put words in your mouth.
That's pretty high on my list. I would say that the poutine element for sure. My favorite comfort food is Chinese food, actually, because I grew up. My dad is from Singapore originally, and so we grew up eating Chinese food all the time. And there's a specific restaurant where I grew up, which is like the one that we always go to, and that's maybe my ideal like comfort food spot in my brain. That's like, ah, this is the one. So
I was truly impressed by the food options in Montreal. I don't know if it's the French kind of legacy there and culture or what, but I was like, hey, this is really good food. At every place I went, it seemed like it was really good food. So you're in a good food city.
Definitely. Yeah.
All right. So Last question here. What is your favorite tool? It can be a software tool, physical tool. Doesn't need to relate to what you do day to day. It's just you'd be bummed if you could never use this tool again.
Yeah. Let me think for a second. Maybe my favorite tool right now is my coffee grinder. I think making coffee at home and working from home has been a good experience. One of the silver linings of the current situation. So I'll give it that.
That's great. Yeah. That's definitely a ritual I couldn't live without. I'll tell you what my favorite tool is. How about that? I recently got a big Berkey water filter. It's just amazing. They've been around for a long time, but it purifies the water. It takes out chlorine and all the things in there, and also takes out the fluoride and arsenic and all these things. And I've just been amazed at how much different just drinking water it is with it. I don't have any relationship with them, but it is truly a great tool for just having pure, clean drinking water around the house.
Yeah, so it's good.
Yeah, you don't have to go out with water bottles and stuff like that.
Totally. And Montreal just has a bunch of scandalous things around lead in the pipes and other kinds of stuff. So I think the city is actually supposed to send me a water filter for my own water, but I already have my own. But I would say plus one to that for sure. Water filters are great tools.
Well, Kevin, we learned a lot today. I feel like this was a combination of a science course and a business class wrapped into one. But as we close, let accredited investors and also companies that may be interested in learning more about, you know, your cannabinoids and how they might partner with you or work with you somehow, how can these two parties work with you, accredited investors and who are interested in investing and also businesses?
Yeah, definitely. I would say our website is the best place to get started. Head over to hyacinthbio.com. You can scroll through the little animation that we've got on our website. People seem to like that a lot. And then we've got a few contact forms at the bottom, which people can choose whichever one they feel like they fall into. And then that'll get sent over to me and leave a bit of information about yourself and what you're looking for. And I'll do my best to help out.
Kevin, thanks so much for coming on the show yet again and, you know, educating us on what's going on. This is a fast-moving industry, and I watch it very closely. And well done with your business, and keep us updated.
Likewise, and glad to be back, and glad to hear, you know, Canada Insider keeping up the good word, and happy to be back again sometime in the future, of course.
If you enjoyed the show today, please consider leaving us a review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever app you might be using to listen to the show. Every 5-star review helps us to bring the best guest to you. Learn more at cannainsider.com/iTunes. What are the 5 disruptive trends that will impact the cannabis industry in the next 5 years? Find out with your free report at cannainsider.com/trends. Have a suggestion for an awesome guest on Canna Insider? Simply send us an email at feedback@cannainsider.com. We'd love to hear from you. Please do not take any information from Canna Insider or its guests as medical advice. Contact your licensed physician before taking cannabis or using it for medical treatments. Promotional consideration may be provided by select guests, advertisers, or companies featured in Canna Insider. Lastly, the host or guests on Canna Insider may or may not invest in the companies or entrepreneurs profiled on the show. Please consult your licensed financial advisor before making any investment decisions. Final disclosure to see if you're still paying attention. This little whistle jingle you're listening to will get stuck in your head for the rest of the day. Thanks for listening, and look for another Canna Insider episode soon. Take care. Bye-bye.